So what is
So now we've done the Swenson 1 clusters, which were done in 87. Then we've done the loop algorithm that was first in 93 and 96 in continuous time. Then the worms were 97. The worms in SSE was 99. Now we're coming to 2001 and 2002. That is, we know how to solve the critical slowing down at the second order phase transition. We don't know yet how to do a spin glass or tunnel through a first order transition. And we don't know how to get the free energy directly. Since all we know is always the relative probabilities of two states, but we don't have the partition function. The way one usually calculates the free energy is you take the fluctuations of the internal energy. From them, you calculate the specific heat. You divide that by T. You integrate it up, and the results are very noisy. So we want to have a direct calculation for the free energy and solve this problem with tunneling. Now, the idea with solving the problem of tunneling is easy. You've got a rough free energy landscape, just make it flat.
It's called microcanonical.
You can do micro canonical, which means that for each energy range, you adjust it manually to get a flat landscape in energy space. The problem with microcanonical is you have to do that by hand in some sense. So that does not scale well. Here, the Wang-Landau method does that for you automatically. You don't have to tune anything. That is the basic idea.
What do you mean by make flat a rough landscape? I mean, you have to sample whatever.
It's flat.
No, just you want to have equal probability of visiting a certain energy level.
Yes.
You want to have a flat distribution in energy space.
Yes.
Then you just make a random walk in energy space.
Yes.
And you will just go to the ground state and back up and down, and there's no problem with tunneling. It's a 1D random walk.
This EI doesn't refer to a particular state, it refers to a particular energy only, right?
So, yes, right. So that means we want to have for the sampling probability that the probability of visiting a certain state I is just the inverse density of state at the energy of that state.
You can still get stuck. Take the IZ model at very low temperatures and then...
You don't have any temperature. You just sample the phase space.
Yeah, you will put it.
The only thing you have is the average energy.
Okay.
Right. So you have only two states at low energies, and you've got 10 to the 40,000 states on a 200 times 200 lattice at the energies roughly in the center of your distribution.
But how do you know how many states you have at that given energy?
That is just the trick of Wang-Landau. So the idea is to, once we have this density of states, which I'll come to on the next slide, then we have a flat landscape and we just do the random walk and it works. And then after we have that, we multiply each level here with the Boltzmann factor and we get the free energy.
But you have to be able to constrain yourself to the energy surface, which is not trivial. You have to sample all the states with a given energy.
No, I sample all the states.
So you shouldn't say, I mean, rho is the exact stuff. I mean, rho is just an approximate.
That's what I wanted.
So
if we know the density of states, let's say, if we know the density of states, rho of an energy E, then we just do local spin flips, and we take as probability of a state the inverse density of state. It's flat, and we're done, and we can just tunnel. There is a method now of approximately getting this rho of E. That I'll show next.
I see.
What that allows us is, for example, for a 10-state POTS model, which has a strong first order the transition on a 200 times 200 lattice, there is one energy level here, the other here, and you have to tunnel from here to there, and the state in between has a relative probability of about 10 to the minus 9. So it would usually take forever to tunnel from here to here. They can tunnel across here in a few hundred local spin flips. Because they make the energy histogram flat. That's how it looks like at DC. That's the logarithmic scale here.
Right, essentially you're trying to calculate a microcanonical entropy now.
Yes.
That reminds me a lot of something which is explained in Kerson Wang book, which is a way to calculate the entropy. Do you know that?
Yes, but this is what you always try to do in Monte Carlo. No, I understand, but
there is a very obscure chapter of a few pages that explain how to do that by following trajectories. And you could never understand it, actually.
So now the main problem is, of course, once we have the density of states, we have it all solved already. So how do we get it? And that's where this method comes in. You change about 3 lines in your local update async code, which is about the 20-line program, and that's all. Namely, for the updates, you don't use the Boltzmann weight, but the ratios of the densities of states. But of course, you don't know what it is, so we start with a guess. Now, the usual guess is you just say it's just one everywhere. That's not the best guess, that's the worst guess actually, but it works.
But what do you mean by rho of e? I mean, you need some probability for each configuration.
It's the number of configurations.
It's 1 over the number of configurations with that energy.
It's microcanonical.
But how are you going to constrain yourself to...
No, I don't. I flip my spin and I change the energy.
Right.
And then I calculate the ratios, and if the new state has a lower density of states, then I rather want to go there. If it has a higher one, then I don't want to go there.
Okay. But for that, you have to assign to each configuration a row.
Yes, correct. So we start with the row of each energy level is just 1.
What confuses me is not each energy level, each spin configuration. It's a very big space.
To each spin configuration, we can assign an energy.
Yes.
And
then you take the product measure.
Count the number of configurations of time energy. Over the total number of configurations.
Yeah. But in principle, if we knew rho of e, we would know absolutely everything.
Right, exactly.
Yes, exactly.
So we are going to calculate rho of e now.
Yeah, right. So it's a way to calculate rho of e for an extensive system.
Exactly. We start with just it's flat and constant. That's horrible and bad, but we start that way. And now you can say that each time you visit an energy level, you increase it there because you've been there once more. So you could do that. You simply count how often you get to each energy level. That has a problem. The problem is in a simple Ising model, 200 times 200, you've got a total of 2 to the 40,000 states. So you've got about 10 to the 10,000 states at any typical energy level. And you will just never be able to count up there by just counting the number of states. So what you do in the sampling, instead of increasing this rho of e by 1 each step, you multiply it with a big number, maybe 10, or we start with e usually. So each time we go there, we increase the logarithm of the number by 1. And we can count up to 10,000 easily. So when we go there, we increase the estimate by this row by a huge number at first, and then we roughly map out the crude shape of row of e.
Right, because the thing you really want is something in the exponential in the beginning.
Because row is the exponential of the entropy.
Yeah, right.
Yes, right. So we want something like this. This is log row, and here it's about 10,000. Right, so we want to go up to large numbers quickly by increasing the log of rho by 1 each time we visit.
Of all the energies of the states? I mean, you do a list of the energies?
No, I keep... For the Ising model, there are only discrete energy levels, a few thousand, and I have an array where for each energy value I store the estimate for rho, or for the logarithm, actually.
Okay, so you get a new energy, you just store it somewhere.
If I get a new energy, I just increment this rho by a factor of.
No, sorry, you mean if you get a new energy value.
So I know the whole range from the start.
Okay, right. But in different models, you don't. I mean, so what do you do then?
I usually have estimates for the lowest possible energy and the highest possible energy.
But you sort of have to assume that even with this non-energy dependent walkthrough configurations, you really sample them all. It could be that you stay in some region and you don't.
Need a method that can sample the configuration space. It has to be ergodic. That's all you need.
It's clear that for infinitesimally small f, this thing converges to the real measure of it, the true one.
What is clear is that as long as the f is big, you will always have errors because the accuracy of rho can't be smaller than this factor of e to the f. What you do next is, once you do that, you keep a histogram how often you've been at each side. Once that is reasonably flat, it will never be perfectly flat, but once it varies by about 10 or 20% only, then you say, okay, I've now got a reasonably flat histogram, I've got a reasonably good estimate at this accuracy level, and now I decrease the f and repeat it.
Can it blow up and sometimes, like an overflow in rho of e?
For that, we store the logarithm of rho, because these numbers will be 10 to the 20,000 easily. Yes. And what we do, that each time it's flatter, actually normalize that the smallest number of log rho is zero. Yes, because I know the total number of states in my model, and so I can normalize it. And I sometimes have to normalize it, as otherwise log rho will overflow.
You normalize h of the order, or some distribution of log of rho?
The log rho is normalized, because the h, once it's flat, I decrease the f, and I start again with a new histogram. Once the f gets small, you are sure that detailed balance is fulfilled, because at each step you change the rho, so you violate detailed balance. And for going there, you take the old rho. For going back, you take the new rho. So detailed balance is violated as long as f is big. Once f gets small, the error or detailed balance gets of the order of f, and it can, and it's okay. The question about convergence, you have to be careful that you don't decrease it too fast. First of all, you have to run long enough to get the crude shape. For that, it's important to start with a good starting value f. That has to be well chosen, so that the sum of the rows can be the total number of states within the number of sweeps that you do.
Is it fair to say that this is a Monte Carlo method with self-consistent weights?
Yes.
I mean, this idea has been around also, I mean, before, right? I mean, you know, this old program, Vegas, I mean, high energy, I mean, where they did adaptive integration.
Yeah.
They basically do something very similar.
Yeah.
Not in state space, though.
The main breakthrough here, compared to the old method, is that first it is this self-adapting. And second, you multiply rho and not just add some numbers, was done together previously. And adding just doesn't scale, it's multiplying that's important. In order to prove how and when this converges to the correct the rho of E, that still hasn't been done, and there some work is needed by some mathematicians. But it seems to work extremely well for the Ising model in 2D, where you know all things, you get the free energy to 4 or 5 digits easily. You find that for first order the transition, like in the Potts model, the free energy looks like this, and then it has a kink. And as you increase your system size, that just scales. It scales nicely to the right TC. For the second order one, so that's slightly smeared. for the second or when it looks perfectly smooth and you just can't see anywhere where there's TC.
And in the second order, around the second order phase transition, does that algorithm do anything, know anything about critical slowing down? Probably not.
There is no critical slowing down, nothing.
Okay,
no,
right.
Nothing.
No temperature, right?
Exactly. It works as well as cluster updates.
Why hasn't it been invented before?
It's so much easier. Three lines change to your code.
Right.
I took my easing program, I rode the bus from Hönkeberg to downtown, and while I was down there, the new code was working. It's a 10-minute bus ride.
Right?
That's for the free energy. Once you have that, you calculate the entropy from it. You don't take derivative of the numerical numbers, because that's, you write down the equation for the
No, but I mean, the question, why wasn't it invented earlier? I mean, you don't just want to study the free energy, and just from the free energy, you usually don't get the observables.
No. What we do next is we do microcanonical measurements for the observables. At each energy level, we also store the expectation value for the measurement at that energy level, and then we get that.
You know what I mean, you know?
Yes.
Right.
You don't need
so
more.
Do they have to give back their grant money from the previous?
Now, okay, so that's easy. And these are, and it has been cited 17 times 1 year after the publication. They have used it for easing model, POTS models, and spin glasses. Improved sampling methods are by Kawashima, by Okabe, and by the Binder group. Then people in chemistry, in medicine, have applied it to protein folding, to polymer films, and to Leonard Jones liquids. They showed that in all cases, this very simple method is as fast or faster than the best involved method they had until now. It's never worse. For POTS models, three-state was done by Okabe's group, reaction co-ordinated dates recently, and for quantum problem, as there, Landau asked me 3 times if I couldn't find a way of doing that. The first 2 times I looked at it and said, no, no way, we can't do that. Since we just can't calculate the energy of a configuration. But then last June I realized, wait a moment, when we do the classical Monte Carlo, we need the energy anyways, and for the quantum, I don't say we can't do that because we don't know the energy. We know how to do it there. So let's look at the methods I showed this morning and see if we can extend them to this the von Landau idea. So we had this SSE representation here, where we wrote the partition function as a high temperature series. And now we can sum all terms at the given n up in a factor g of n, which is the number of graphs in a certain order of your configurations. And now I can just do my local updates or my cluster updates and use as a weight of a configuration not beta to the n times the matrix elements, but the matrix elements divided by the number of configurations in this order. And since the expectation value for the energy is nothing but the average order divided by the temperature, this n kind of plays the role of the energy. And so we now do our updates by modifying the abilities to not include the beta, but have this 1 over g factor in there. That's all. It's a 3-line change of the code. And it works. Now, Hartmut, you do strong coupling expansions. Let's just do them. We take the Hamiltonian, H0 plus lambda times some perturbation V, and that I write as sum over my bond terms, as this morning, but some have a factor lambda in front. Now, for each term here, I just count how many lambdas appear, and I've got the lambda get to the n times some g of n lambda. But now I stay at a fixed temperature, low temperature, and do the expansion in the orders here of the perturbation. Can drive it up to order 20,000, 30,000 or more. Or I can do the expansion both in temperature and in the couplings if I want to. We had the idea on the 31st of May. We wrote the codes in June, ran some examples. We calculated the TC of a 3D the quantum Heisenberg model to 3 digits in 1 week and on 1 PC. Here I show these heat for systems of 8, I think it's 4 cubed, 8 cubed, 12 cubed, and 16 cubed. And here we plot the structure factor divided times the length, the power of minus 2 plus eta, and that should show a crossing at TC. Does it nicely. You see, these were 4 simulations, one on a system of 4 cubed, 8 cubed, 12 cubed, and 16 cubed. And each one gives us the whole temperature range, all quantities. What the next model was for a quantum model, a Heisenberg bilayer, where when we have a strong coupling on the rungs between the two planes, then we form singlets. Yeah. When it's weak, it's ordered. So we define here is the transition. It's again four simulations.
I see. It's close to what?
2.5. Yeah. Again, about 1 weekend on the PC.
And during weekdays?
What do you do during the week? That was the question.
During the week, writing the paper and submitting it to be faster than the others, because we thought that since we had the idea and missed it for a year, we're so late. So then I was flying to Toulouse, met there with Fabio Alle, who worked with me on reweighting thing, which this is based on. And then I told him that I now had this idea, and he said, "Oh, he had also had this idea, but it doesn't work, and he just had one single bug in the code." So he's a co-author now. Then I met Naoki last month after this out, and he said his student was just too slow. So it is straightforward. It takes you about an hour to change your code.
Right. This D to GN, I mean, do you need it exactly, or can you also live with an approximation
of
G of N?
If you have an approximation to start with, it will speed up convergence.
Right. Mm-hmm.
No. Why?
How do you know where to truncate?
That's easy. I do all my simulations always at a finite temperature anyways, and I scale that with the system size. I can't work in the ground state.
Yeah, but how do you know how to pick lambda?
Yes. So this series will have an order n where it's maximal. And that is simply given by the fact that the expectation value of n is the energy at the temperature times beta. So the, if we could have some light. So since the expectation value of the energy is a function of temperature, is just minus 1 over, is just minus the energy divided by the temperature T. So if I say that when n is large, it will not fluctuate much around that. So I choose something which is slightly bigger than this value. And that I can estimate that this energy here, that the E over T will always be, since this is the absolute value, will always be smaller than the absolute, so the value of the ground state energy density times the volume divided by the temperature. So that this is about the estimate for the cutoff lambda. Theta times volume again times the energy scale of your system. The way we check that is if ever the random walk. Okay, so in the standard Monte Carlo, if ever the random walk reaches the largest size, then we stop and restart it with a larger lambda. Here, what we see is that this gives us a cutoff on the lowest temperature that we can reach. And I here had the plot of the quantum model of the specific heat, for example. I didn't plot that to lower temperatures, because what happens is you've got this beautiful peak, then it goes like this, and then it just shoots off and diverges. So you clearly see where the cutoff is. See, here it's just garbage. Then that's why there's a cutoff here in temperature around 0.35 or so. Now, the big questions I have is, this method seems to work so well for proteins, for spin glasses. Well, somehow there must be a problem somewhere with the method, which we just haven't found yet. So we now test it on the spin glass problem and then want to use it for the quantum spin glasses. For a classical 3D Ising spin glass, they've done it up to system sizes of 20 cubed. The record that was done until now was about 12 cubed. They go to lower temperature and bigger system sizes. It all seems to work well, so.
So they do Edwards Anderson model,
yes,
on 20 cubed?
On 20 cubed, down to 0.1 of the spin glass temperature.
Who's done that?
Wang and Landau, in this paper.
I see.
And that was just one sample, takes them 4 hours on a 20 cubed system. So here, I think we need more checks on how reliable that is by testing it further. But it really seems to work magically well. You just forget about temperature, you sample in energy space. Of course, you have to be able to reach the configurations in your local moves. And one case where that's a problem is hard disks, for example. And that's what I mentioned at a talk I gave in August in San Diego at the APS meeting there. And then Landau said, yes, but that's no problem either. You just take, instead of the energy, you take the density as your parameter. But I guess there might be some problems where it's just so hard to reach the low energy configuration that might not work, but for the spin glass, you can reach it easily in local updates. There's a simple route if you know which way to go. Sure, you can.
Sorry, where is the sign problem gone? I mean, that's what I was just saying. You can now put something complex into your instead of your Boltzmann factor, right?
Why is there a sign problem there?
The sign problem is still there. The rho phi has to be positive for the, which it is. But for the quantum problem, this here you've got your matrix elements of the Hamiltonian in here, and this is the acceptance probability for a move. And here you got get your matrix elements in here, and that's where you get your sign problem back.
So what happens if you apply that to frustrated quantum magnets?
You have a sign problem.
It's still because, I mean, it's still an amplitude and not a probability.
But
yes.
And why not for a spin glass, classically?
For in a classical spin glass, the frustration is in the diagonal part, and that you can remove by. Okay, and that's no problem classically because you take the exponential of your energy. But in the quantum case, you take the matrix element directly. The diagonal one you can change locally by a shift, but you can't do that for the off-diagonal one. So you have a triangle, three exchanges, and you get a minus sign here. So this GFN is no longer positive.
But when you say you're planning to apply that to the quantum spin glass?
To an Ising spin glass in a transverse field.
Ah,
yes.
That's the catch. Okay.
Yes. That should be easier than the classical one because it fluctuates more. Okay. Yes, the sign problem remains. But I guess we've solved most other problems. Except fermions. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the summary.
Very good.
Okay, so we can now do all the free energy tunneling. And the sign problem is the big challenge.
Good. Mm-hmm.